call this second monthly meeting of the Port of Port Townsend for Wednesday, March 26, 2014, to order.
Stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, let's see. We have the approval of the agenda as the first item on the agenda, so are there any additions or corrections?
Yes, sir. I would like to add, under potential immediate action, something just came up today.
Okay.
I briefed you earlier, it's the voting infrastructure grant.
Yep. BIG grant. Potential immediate actions. Got it. Okay, any other additions or corrections, or additions to the minutes, or to the agenda?
Yes, the executive session, there is going to be an executive session.
Oh, there is going to be an executive session for litigation under 42.30.001 parentheses I.
1110.
What?
Not 110.
1110, it says.
Right.
Isn't that what I said?
No.
It's just not. Okay, what she said. And is there going to be an opinion, a decision made?
No decision.
Okay.
No.
And?
No.
If I'm delegated to you.
That's true.
And for 20 minutes?
15.
15 minutes, okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so do we have motion to approve the agenda?
I'll make a motion. I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, for the consent agenda, is there any discussion on the consent agenda? Okay, we want to move to approve the consent agenda?
I'll make a move to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, public comments not related to the agenda. No public comments not related to the agenda, so we'll go right into the second reading. This is an action item, the Breakwater Engineer contract.
We actually do not have a contract ready for tonight. And Jim, if you would bring us up to date since you've talked to Shane.
Sure. I've been working with Shane Phillips from Coast and Harbor Engineering to try to get a scope of work that actually can make sense so we can make a decision on how to move forward. The initial numbers he gave us for engineering, the first phase, were $102,000. And it kind of took Larry and I aback a bit. We feel that we really need a lot more discussion with the commission as to what the commission would like to do with Point Hudson. So we've sent him back to the drawing table to say, why don't you refine your scope of work, come up with a number that will allow us to really evaluate what we want to do before we spend a lot of time researching. He had in his scope of work doing survey work, topographical survey, hydrographic survey, and I think it's really too premature to do that. So he's going to come back to me hopefully tomorrow or the next day with the scope of work. I'll put it in your boxes or put it in your Dropbox so that you can see. And what I've suggested to him is give us an idea of, or five ideas of what we could do and an estimate on what they would cost to do each one of those. And then the commission can decide what direction for him to go in and spend monies more wisely, if nothing else. So that's kind of where we are.
So it's five ideas on five different ways to do just the engineering part of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different things we can do. Why would you put a Band-Aid on it, which I don't think anyone thinks we should put a Band-Aid on it. There's partial rebuilds, what's the worst part of it? What scared Larry and I the most was he was throwing out numbers of $2 and $3 million for this breakwater. And what we need to do is figure out what's really needed to happen instead of just saying it's going to be $3 million to replace the breakwater. But do we really need to do that? Or can we just do the outer wing wall? He's going through now and giving us options of what he believes, from an engineering point of view, really needs to happen right now. At the end of the day, it could come out that we need to replace the entire breakwater, but that's a decision we're going to have to make as far as based on sound engineering data.
And on the workshop on the 9th, we'll have Alan Dashen's firm here to give you a financial update. And you sat down on the meeting the other day, and we'll have a better feel for just what our financial capabilities are over the next 2, 3, 4 years, given other projects that are also going to be hitting us during that same time frame. So.
I thought you guys communicated to those engineers quite adequately that you were looking for what you just stated.
I thought we did, and that's why
it was pretty clear, so they apparently didn't quite understand that.
Well, yeah, they're good people, you know, they're well respected throughout the port industry, and we've used them before, and, but sometimes there's a little bit of I was looking for about a $30,000 figure. Jim was estimating maybe $40,000, and when the 102 came in, I just, let's go to the number two selectee. That's still an awesome option. If we can't come to some agreement, we reserve the right to say, well, thank you for the trying, but we'll go to the next guy.
When do you think we would have a discussion about what we want to do with the breakwater?
How do you?
When would we have a discussion with, when do you think?
Hoping for the workshop.
On the 9th?
Yeah.
Where we're going to say we want to do X, Y, or Z.
Wow.
That's what we got to start on this project. We know it's going to be at least a year and a half permitting, so we're going to make sure we move forward.
Yeah, we got to make that decision on what level of repair we want to do so if they can go far enough with the engineering and the drawings, because you need, what, 75%? To give the Corps of Engineers, Wildlife, DNR, all the agencies. Here's what we want to build. It's not to say we still can't tweak it, but they need that much so that they can start assessing, the impact and go through the permitting process.
Well, there's more than one way to skin a cat, whether 9 or 10. I mean, it's falling apart. There's only a couple ways to do it. I see, one with piles, one with sheet piles, and I mean, I don't know how many different ramifications and.
Well, we might be able to add more riprap, which is the cheapest version of breakwaters. And, extend the riprap out further along the initial part and then maybe replace the outer part, some combination like that.
The other option is to phase it in. Do all the permitting now and phase it in over the next 3 to 5 years. So that's an option too.
And the walkway itself, as we talked before, that was funded by RCO. And I think we should. Do that separately and try to go for grant money for that portion of it. We'll have more to talk about this because this floating infrastructure grant has to do with this breakwater too.
So since this has been the second reading column, there really isn't any action to be taken tonight because we haven't got the contract.
We just put it there when we had to do the agenda because we already had the first reading.
Got it.
So
okay.
It'll be a third reading.
If you wanted to make any decisions tonight.
You might have to hear.
Okay. All right, so then let's go back to the first reading, discussion only, for the poplar tree removal.
Yeah, I just want to make sure you're aware of this because you may have some citizens call you. Also, I wanted to, on a public record, the discussion. If you remember about a year ago, Guy Sands called me up and asked me to come down, and I went down there, and if you go in their tasting room at the brewery, there's a huge crack all the way across the floor, and you can actually see the concrete where it's, when you walk on it, it's not that dramatic, but you can feel, it's a bulge there, right at the crack,
yeah.
And then you can follow it under the wall out into the asphalt parking lot. On the inside of the Boat Haven side of the building. And he also had some photos. He was installing some tanks in the rest of the building. When they dug up the concrete to install the tanks, they found probably 30 feet of poplar roots that were 3-4 inches in diameter, and which was causing that to crack. Now they replaced that, they cut those roots out. So we talked to the city. Part of the problem with poplars, we didn't plant them, the city didn't plant them. H.J. Carroll, who was a local real estate guy and a philanthropist, planted them all on both sides of Sims Way. And some of the poplars are on our property, Some are on the city, but all of them are in the state right away because this is a state highway out here. And of course, you got the power lines going through and everything else. So, long story short, we agreed with the city that we hired a tree expert, Katie Bigelow. And she came up and looked at it, and Ken Klo, public works from the city, was down, and we went through her assessment. And if you want, here, I brought her report. And her assessment was, you can try, which we did, was to trench between the building and the trees and try to cut the roots. The trouble is, the biggest tree, which is causing the most problem right on the corner, you've got public utilities right in there too, so we really couldn't trench as much as we wanted. And to quote Ms. Bigelow, "These would be a temporary solution. I strongly recommend developing a plan for removing these trees and replanting with more appropriate species, a variety of species that will not interfere long-term with the power lines or building infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. If the poplars are removed, their stumps should be ground out to prevent sucker regrowth." And because poplars are good at that. So anyway, it's really getting bad down there. Guy sent me an email, and it's in your packet. And I called up the city, told David Timmons and Ken Klo that I'm going to go ahead and take these two trees out. They gave us a no-cost permit to do so. They asked that we would replant a 2-to-1 ratio. So if we're going to take two trees out, we got to plant four trees. And we're looking at various species right now. We already contacted the Esplanda people. That's the German pronunciation of it. So we had a debate on that yesterday. They can get to it mid-April to late April, work it into their schedule. And you have to have somebody like them who's qualified to work around the power line. You just can't get somebody with a chainsaw out there. So I just wanted to let you know, in case you get a call from a citizen, that's what we're doing. We're trying to save our infrastructure and an active, ongoing business. In the future, we're going to do it on the other side because we're noticing in Susie, the coffee roaster building, we're starting to see cracks over there. Just like, not as bad as the brewery, but...
What about PSE or... the city with utilities and stuff? I would think they're getting...
The utility PUD comes through, well, PSE formally, and trim around the power line. That's all they would do, so...
But is there underground stuff in there that could get affected by the roofs?
The city is already involved with their sewer and water lines, so...
Think it'd be a cost?
Yeah, it's, initially we just asked for the fur of the big tree, and it was a little over $5,000. So the other tree will be a lot less than that because they're already mobilized, and it's a smaller tree. I would estimate about $7,000.
So in here it says the roots of at least two poplar trees. Well, those are the two towards the corner then?
Where yeah, sorry, if you're looking, standing across at Safeway, looking at the entrance, the first two trees on the right is... You come into the
boat. Well, those two trees wouldn't be the ones that had the roots that had been going underneath into the back in the brewing room.
They were.
Aren't those farther back?
Those weren't the ones. It was that big one on the corner that went under the building and then went down the length of the building.
Oh, so that would take care of the ones that were that they cut the roots out of, but then they put concrete back over. Okay. Right.
So it's going to happen next month. That's it.
Okay. Next, environmental rate discussion.
At the last meeting, staff took away that you wanted this back on the agenda and for a possible decision about cutting the rate in half right now to $5 as an interim measure until we do our marina survey, which we're well into. And we could have the results of that by the workshop with appropriate graphs and spreadsheets and everything. So you asked for some of the impact, and I was gone on Friday when you wrote this up. It was reduced by $23,000 and change for this year.
No, wait a minute. Is that the thing that is written in here on the background?
Mm-hmm. Midway down in the background.
Larry, is that the loss based on a 50%?
If we went to $5 for the rest of the year. That's right.
I have some questions in regards to what's really proper, normal accounting practices and developing new cost centers and how that should be, you know, appropriated through, you know, through, you know, the various stakeholders. And in this case here, we've seen some information that demonstrates that a significant part of the expenses that were pulled out of that cost center for last year are actually indeed going to the level three response, which is going to be a capital item, as far as I know, in regards to the investments we're going to have to make in the future. And with that said, there's also the issues of, you know, when is a surcharge, you know, from an accounting standpoint, again, properly administered, and what, you know, what's it to be used for, and is the money for that surcharge being directed towards exactly what the surcharge is called, in this case, environmental fee. And it seems to be that there's some fuzzy areas there that I've been having a hard time getting a handle on. And also that start blending these costs and things kind of get mashed into this category of environmental, even makes it even more complicated process. And my past experience with having a specific cost center developed, like in this case for environmental, items that were normally an operating expense before the environmental cost center even existed, such as garbage, for example, was not, when the new cost center was developed, if you had an operating expense, and in this case, disposal, I'm using that for example, that was not put into the environmental cost center because garbage is like a utility. I mean, if we got to pay that bill, just like we got to pay the you know, the power and the water and so on. So I guess what I'm getting at is really having a hard time getting my mind wrapped around these numbers and what we're really looking at, you know, and what specifically are we trying to pay for with this environmental cost center. And I can see, you know, that from the standpoint of, like, we're going to have new regulatory requirements coming down the pike at us. We know that's going to be happening in the future. You know, it's okay. That's possibly for that. But then again, if it's a requirement that's going to necessitate a capital improvement, then it really isn't going to be coming out of that, because we're going to be establishing, you know, a new capital project and then following through with, you know, the appropriate, whether it's going to be borrowing money or whatever, that's, you know, from an accounting standpoint for that. So we've gone over this issue a whole lot, and it's getting really kind of bogged down. It seems like we could really do ourselves and a lot of people are involved a favor and figure out a way to simplify this. Just reducing it down, cutting it in half. I understand, you know, the spirit of what that's supposed to accomplish or hope to accomplish, and that is to redirect, or maybe that's not the correct way to say it, but to direct the where these costs are being originated from to the stakeholders involved in that point. In this case, the mortgage holders have pretty clearly demonstrated that these expenses are not coming from the marina. No, they're coming from elsewhere. So I just wanted to...
My thought on that is that this seems like, I mean, it's got its heart in the right place, because it's just like I said, it's trying to redirect it. But I think that we've already agreed that we don't really want to be having an environmental fee. I mean, you know, in principle...
For the marine.
Yeah, for the, well, an environmental fee.
Well, maybe for the yard, too, we talked about,
yeah,
this charging, yeah, whatever the right base fee.
Yeah, just get the market rate and go with that, and then... And then we get the fun time of arm wrestling over, well, what should be a capital expense in the environmental arena? Should that be just made a capital for the level three, or should just, since we know we're going to be putting money in environmental from now on until eternity, we just call the environmental thing what it is? And but it, instead of assessing a feed, any user group, we just charge the correct market rates for the mortgage tenants and the marine trades and the, well, everybody. And then we just take it out of the general fund. But having the environmental line item there would give us a way to assess, you know, how much we're having to spend for it and track if we're going to get better or you know, how much more the thing's going to be calling us. But then how much of it comes from general fund to go to environmental. So I think that myself, since we're already well on the way to getting the mortgage fees and the yard haul-out fees from all of the whole Puget Sound, we just realized that this was a good thought and it was from the right place, but we just wait until we get the fees that are market rate and then call them that, the fees, eliminate the environmental fees, and then figure out from where in the general fund with these different figures that we have for the yard fees and the mortgage fees, where the money's going to come from environmental, because we've been tracking it for years, so we know how much is going to come out of where. So I would say just wait until the next meeting when we have the, hopefully we'll have the results for the market analysis.
The last time we had this discussion, it was sounded like it could be many, many weeks, if not months down the road. Now all of a sudden we're going to have this done quickly?
Julie, to her credit, got on this thing and she's knocking it up. It's just the marina one. She's still got to do the yard one. But she's had a lot of success. She's 87 marinas now. Some marinas, you know, as soon as you start asking them, they hang up on you. And some of the marinas are titled marinas, but they're really dry storage uplands, so we took them off the list. But yeah, she's getting it together. We just need to populate a spreadsheet and see what it's telling us yet. But we think we'll have it all done by the workshop.
Well,
I don't know about the yard rates. But
yeah, the yard rates. We probably still need another month to tackle that one.
So I had an interesting conversation with Bertram about this, and I heard Bertram's comments about the level three and you know, that being a capital expense. It's interesting. So if you look at the, I mean, if we have the number of 261, which seems to be what you're saying the number is, Amy, as far as a annual environmental fee for 2014.
That's what the salaries and contract for service and supplies and such, yes.
Right, and that's coming off of this page in the back, right? On your report, nothing I want to jump the gun.
Populated for a year, yeah.
Right. I mean, I'm with you, Brad. I understand where you're coming from. It's just, I also want to do due diligence as far as the public is concerned, and I don't want to take an expense and just say, okay, we're going to run this at a deficit. I mean, how are we going to cover this expense? So we're covering 50% of this expense right now, and now we're saying we're going to cover maybe less 40% of this expense. What do we say to that?
Well, again, I'm really struggling with it.
I'm with you all the way. I'm just saying, how do we?
But I'm kind of going to I'm looking at it from a different standpoint, from an actual accounting standpoint, and what's actually being allocated to this cost center, and I kind of have issue with that, actually. You know, I'm just using garbage for an example. There can be other things that pop up as well, but garbage is a pretty significant expense.
Yeah, we haven't counted yet. I think it should be. But
there's a minimal amount of garbage, and it's just when they're hauling away environmental items. Okay. So there is, our garbage bill is roughly $40,000, and it's not in here. Mm-hmm.
But I think, and we're struggling with it, you know, this is the first year we've had a designated environmental cost center.
Right.
And I think it's going to take some massaging on all of our parts at the end of the year. Okay, we were right, this needs to be included. We didn't include this, it should be, or geez, we counted this and it probably shouldn't be. And, you know, the level three, we are throwing additional money out of the general fund to do the level three. But you're right, there are elements of that. We're getting ready to do the testing of the roof runoff, you know, treatment. Well, we're paying for that with this as a capital expense this extra money, but that's going to become a regular expense as we, you know, change out the media over the years. So that's going to add to the overall cost of environmental. So some of the level three initially is paid for by the general fund, but it's going to be part of the ongoing cost of it. And I'm not sure, I think it's always going to be subsidized. I just...
So it's like, what level do we want to subsidize it? The only other comment I would have, I'm with you all the way again, Brad, is, and this is kind of where I see, you know, Kevin being important with the website and us having more of a presence within the public, like through either through the paper or through the website or something, where, so if we increase Shipyard Guys up to 70, I would think, I mean, I know, I mean, none of them are here tonight, and I know most of them would be kind of blindsided if suddenly we said, oh, we just voted to up you guys to 70 bucks for all your customers. So, I mean, it seems like between, this is first reading, so between now and second reading, we should be sure they all know that we're considering, if we're going to keep it at par, try and keep the level covered at par and go down some, we should be sure they know they're going to go up.
And I talked to a couple of boat owners in the yard, and a lot of it is the salesmanship of it.
Yeah.
You know, they know it costs money. They know it's a business that produces a lot of environmental waste and everything. But, yeah, we tend to do this. We tend to nickel and dime our customers with all these individual little fees. And I think, as Steve was saying, if we can arrive at an appropriate base fee, it may not cover all the environmental costs, but I think it needs to cover more than it is in the yard right now. But it just sells better if they just, here's what it costs, one figure. And, okay, $30 of that's going to environmental. They really don't care. It's like my analogy with the hotel across the street. You pay 80 bucks for the night, you don't know that $2 of it went to, say, garbage or something.
Well, I'm just concerned that we're going to open up this whole rate schedule for the marina and, you know, the tenants, permanent tenants, as well as transient. And John Collins, and with stakeholders involved, I mean, they put together a pretty good process for establishing what's fair rates, and that's what's existing today. And I sure don't want to throw that out the window either. You know, we need to take that into consideration. And just doing a study of marinas around Puget Sound is, I mean, that's part of the equation. You know, it's what's, you know, what's the average family wage, you know, in our area compared to those other areas where the study's done. You know, and there's going to have to be some sort of numbers thrown towards that too. Otherwise, we're not going to be making direct comparisons. We can't compare our rates against, you know, some place like Bellingham or you know, King County for that matter, you know, that's gonna, you know, the, obviously the average family wage income is gonna be much higher. At least I assume it will be. And so just, this is a, it's not gonna be a simple process. You know, there's gonna be a lot of, you know, information we have to consider if we're gonna be looking at changing rates for our moorish tenants.
Yeah, well, I wasn't planning on throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think that the square foot thing that Bertram and John Collins and everyone came up with is a useful thing. And we can get these figures and figure out what the market rate actually is, and then utilize, see if we can figure out a way to utilize their square foot measurement design to incorporate that to where that's where.
I don't think anybody was recommending we do away with that formula.
No. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a, I think it's a really useful thing. And,
I think the responsible thing for everyone is to make sure we're being careful with this number, the 261 number, that it is, I mean, we're putting into it what we say we're putting into it, which is, you know, an environmental cost related to, like, the stormwater runoff and the downspout. I mean, we're trying to solve this issue of what we're doing here at the port. And at the end of the day, we got to say the number is this and be able to defend it, and then say we're going to subsidize it to this level and, and move forward.
Good. Go ahead, Bertram.
There's so many things. I really appreciate the fact that you've all stayed on this and brought this up. Thanks, Pete, for bringing this to a first reading here. And we had a great discussion that time with all of you. You know, just before I say anything, I'll just comment on the rates, by the way. I did a little calculations, and I showed this to Pete, that she'll show for a 40-foot slip is $471, and here it's $339. And if you take the mean family income in Seattle, which is $70,000, and here, which is $48,000, and do a ratio, it comes out 68% for both places. It's right on the money, and we're only 10, and our rates are only 10% difference between Port Angeles. In other words, if you take mean family income and the mortgage rates in Port Angeles, here and in Shilshul, they all come out pretty much the same. We're kind of pretty much on the level. Just as an aside on that.
You know, it's an interesting comment to make with that, is like if you took, were you talking about Shilshul?
Yes.
Yeah, so if you took Shilshul, Shilshul really doesn't do what we do with this yard. So, like the cost that we're incurring, a large chunk, like you've said, of the environmental rate is what's happening right out here over the ground. If we didn't have that, that could be an interesting, I mean, it would be more, you see what I'm saying? As far as a marina versus marina, without, I mean, they don't really have a shipyard like we do.
Well, then we can have these discussions, and also, before I start, I'll just say, I put together a kind of a worksheet, a study guide for Environmental Cost Center, which I'm going to send you by email. It would be great if we could sit down and look. I put down what things we want to learn from looking at an Environmental Cost Center, and see if using those, not that I have the answer on how to put the cost center together, but it considers each of the sectors, and you can see them and see if, when you get the cost center all put together, if you could look at it and get answers from it as a result of that. So I'm going to send that to you right now. I think that I have serious questions with the figure of 261. There is at least $100,000 of that that I could sequester out, including $34,000 for depreciation. So, and I sent, last time I discussed those, but I don't feel those figures are solid. And for example, Landau has really clearly stipulated what is for the new construction state for level 3 and what's for level 2, and it's $18,000. And we know we've added another employee because of the level 3 burdens. Still, we don't know how much of Al's effort, and then Karen has put a number of hours into the negotiations for the level 3. So it's a no problem. So I think that I wouldn't, if you want to try and equalize any changes in the rates on the basis of going for that 261 target, I'd be very careful. I think that that's not a clear number. What I've tried to say is if you can get a business plan for level 3, just like you would build a building, starting with development, and there are many insecurities, as you say, the state keeps throwing new stuff at it. You have to have contingencies, just as Landau gave us a $4,500 contingency. You have to build in contingencies for Karen's time and for all these other things, but try and get an overall business plan starting now instead of nibbling away at it until you get to the point where you're putting out for contract. Then you get an idea of how much you have in the general fund in order to pay for it. And that's the idea behind setting out level 3. And once it's completed, then the environmental costs will be different because you're going to have a much more complicated system. And at that point, if you have a good accounting system, you'll be able to adjust your rates accordingly. From the mortgage tenant standpoint, we're not looking for a discount in this fee. It's not about the dollars. It's a trust thing, as Brad pointed out. And you, when we negotiated with John Collins, we were tired, the port was tired of every year having this drama thing, you know, about what's the rates going to be and all this. And we wanted stability, the port wanted stability. The port was having trouble figuring out an area formula. Don Haviland just died 2 months ago, and I myself came up with a plan, and with John Collins we found something. It was more expensive for us, but it was worth it to have the stability and to know that every year it was a formula of increase. It was about $40,000 a year. It keeps moving up a little bit but we know it's happening, and we feel good. We feel, you know, what it is. We've created it. When the environmental fee came along, we, being stewards, we thought, oh, okay, well, we'll pay it. So we paid it, and we paid it for several years. But when it was raised, then suddenly we questioned it, and we found out that we got the feeling that our trust was violated, that we were being sidestepped to sequester more money for us. And if we lost the faith in the port for that. It wasn't because of a lack of money, as you know, as we've talked. You're getting plenty of money from us. You get almost $500,000, which you use for whatever, and including $120,000, which you're sequestering for supposedly the reserve fund, but it's going into general fund. You're getting plenty of money, so it's not like you're not covering it. And the beautiful financial report that Amy put out, I read it. It's really great to see what the board's doing. But in it, you know, there was we haven't had any $45 of the environmental fee expenses went into the marina this last 2 months. And I checked the records yesterday in the spill log, and there's only been 4 reports and no action. So we feel like there's enough money to cover it, and we feel like it's kind of a break in faith. And I think that's what it comes down to. It's not looking for a discount. And you have the money. So I would suggest that you really, if you want to be happy to take a look at those figures with you, but look at that environmental 260, say what is real here, what is not. Don't be so pressured by the fact that, oh, we got to get the budget to balance, because you have money coming in. You know, take away that and the environmental fee and in the port, and then you need to look at the yard. And I mean, I talked to Shannon and Doug. I said, what about $70? And people will object. I said, well, what about 50? They balk, but they agree to it. You know, they roll with us and say, 70 suddenly sounds a lot. She itemized for me a 30-foot boat is $198 to get hauled out, $70 for environmental, $35 for washdown, $35 for tarp. You know, it's expensive. So if you have a fiberglass boat, if you have all those things itemized, you're going to say, well, I'll just do it every other year. It might affect the cost. You don't know that. But those are something you're going to have to really look at. I agree. You've got to pay for the environmental costs out of either the rentals, which are hard to do, and the yard, which is probably your best source, because that's the biggest source. So anyway, those are my comments. Do you have any questions about that?
So you're, Bertram, you're still after, I mean, even though marine tenants were paying 10 and we were talking 5, you're still after just get rid of them altogether, or you'd take 5?
No, I'm not interested in the discount. I think it's the principle here that we feel violated by this, and we feel like we need to go back to the trusted formula that we've accepted, even though it's more expensive than the old formula, and just do that. And it's not that you're not getting covered for our portion of it from the receipts. You're getting plenty of money from the mortgage, and you can use all of that excess revenue for whatever you want. That's your business. And as we talked about, the reserve fund has been targeted for other things. Sounds like my car went start. the reserve fund, really, it's going to the general fund. It's going to. Anyway, that would be my.
My understanding of a surcharge and what's appropriate for a surcharge. If you're gonna charge a customer, whatever, say it's a customer of yours, and you are adding on a surcharge, that there actually needs to be a tangible thing, an expense that demonstrates against that surcharge. In this case, we can't show that. We don't have it because there are no expenses against the marina for this environmental fee. I mean, other than just a few bucks here and there, there's not, none. And so what's acceptable from an accounting, charging your customer standpoint, calling it a surcharge at all, in my opinion, is quite wrong in the case of the marina tenants, because there is no money going towards the marina for this from an environmental standpoint.
I understand. You can also argue that when John and you guys sat down and set up the rate structure, we didn't have these costs that we do today in terms of the environmental fee. I mean, am I correct that when the 3 years ago...
Some percentage. It's gotten a lot worse in the last few years.
It's grown exponentially to what we have today.
True, but we didn't... even today, those costs are not relevant to the marina because right. They're not responsible for the marina. And if you want to use the revenue from the marina to pay for those, that's your job to make those decisions, not mine. That's your money. So we've been steadily providing with about $500,000 every year to be able to use for. And, you know, the thing's going to come up, but 216, the heavy haul-out will be paid for, and maybe some light will come. Things. So I don't think that's quite relevant.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I think those are very useful comments. Thank you, Bertram. I think that they might just all get resolved by themselves if maybe I should make sure that what I was thinking of proposed is clear, and that is that when we review these schedules, the yard schedule and the mortgage schedule, all these schedules, keeping intact the square foot thing, the square foot basis, and we go through these and we just get completely rid of the environmental fee. Like Larry said, we no longer call it an environmental fee. It's just, this is the fee, and this is the fee based on real science because of what the market rate is, that then the Bertram's thing of fairness will be back into play. And like he said, he acknowledges that we have more money that we need to, that comes from them, that we have to spend on environmental. So we'll get these market rates for the yard and for the mortgage, completely eliminate any surcharges. So there won't be the surcharge word or name or anything in there. And then we'll then it'll be our job to take the money, the revenues that come in from these revised. And who knows, they might not change much at all. I think that if I'm not mistaken, someone said that some of our all-out rates are a little bit cheap, but they may change a lot, they may change a little. But we'll take those revised rates that we have, we can suddenly hang our hat on because we've gotten real data from real mortgage and real yard rates around the sound, which is our market. And then our job is to discover from that, go through the environmental costs, figure out what they really are, and determine where the money that comes from the extra mortgage, how it gets paid for the environmental costs. So then we can tweak our environmental costs in now that we're monitoring and see where we can save on. I've got some ideas that are coming down later, but.
Quick comment on the surcharge thought too is, you know, like when we're in the boat world, if my fuel suddenly jumps 2 bits a gallon, I got to get that back. I can't just eat that. And so I have, particularly as a UTC licensed passenger ferry operator, I have the ability to place a surcharge, an immediate surcharge on my rate. And the reason I can do that is because I have to, my rates are all regulated by the government. So they've given me the ability to put that surcharge on to protect myself. And so I think as we go through this discussion, you know, how we look at the environmental fee, we call it environmental fee, whatever this cost is, I think it's wise of us to decide, you know, is this a cost that has the potential to vary year to year? I mean, not be very consistent like a utility charge, like a garbage charge, but rather be fairly volatile because of the unknown of what we don't know we're going to be faced with.
I don't think it would be too volatile. You know, they're getting ready to rewrite the boatyard permit.
Yeah.
You know, as a betting man, I'll bet my year salary that the restrictions, benchmarks are going to get more strict. But it's rewritten every 5 years, so even though we may have a spike, that will kind of know what we're facing for the next 5 years. But over time, it's still going to go up. And,
yeah.
And I'm of a firm belief that we're never going to be able to charge enough to cover all these. It's always going to be subsidized. Whether we take the profit margin we make on the RVs and apply it to this, you know, this will be the commission decision how we handle the deficit. But it's just going to, the cost of doing business is getting higher and higher and higher. But we don't want to raise the mortgage, and we don't want to raise the yard rates to a point where we lose mortgage customers or we stop getting these boats down from Alaska. The reason why they come down here is they can justify all that fuel cost to get down here because the rates are pretty darn low. Mm-hmm. And they are low. They're the lowest in Puget Sound. I'm here to tell you that. Mm-hmm. And but if we start bouncing those up, then we're going to start seeing boats not coming back next year and the year after. So it's a delicate balance. It's going to be hard.
Okay, so the next item is February 2014 financials.
Amy.
You guys have the February financials. Through February 28th, our gross operating revenues were $736,000. That was $71,000 over 2013 and $88,000 over the projected. The workyard, shipyard, environmental and Point Hudson properties are showing the largest increases over the prior years, and the only department showing a slight decrease is Quilsing. It's just been really slow out there, fuel sales included. So,
did you get my email, Steve?
Which one?
After our meeting this afternoon, I sent you an email about your question on the nightly RV revenue.
Oh, yeah, I did. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So our total operating expenses, less depreciation, were $548,000. This is $14,000 less than 2013 and $98,000 less than budgeted. A lot of that is just due to the timing of when we're getting the bills in, and an effort to try to get these out a little more timely. We're doing the best we can, but some of the bills are just very haphazard right now. So at this point, we have a net loss from operations of $47,000, but if you bring in the overall net income is $50,000 when you bring in our non-operating, and a lot of that is because we're spreading the property tax revenue out over 12 months, so that's, even though we're not getting it quite that evenly. So behind there are all the same individual reports, and then I also have done up a couple where we're recommending that possibly we have a new report writing tool to do the reports now because the other one is not supported anymore.
We have a new what? I'm sorry.
Report writing tool to do our monthly reports.
Software.
Uh-huh. And so it's much easier to pick out some of the proposed. We talked last time about combining the yard, so I did a sample of what that would look like. I combined the yard, however, I kept the 70-75 ton hoist revenue as well as the 300 ton hoist revenue separate, as well as workyard, shipyard, actual yard revenue. All the other small revenue items I combined and then combined all the expenses just so you guys could see what it would look like if we just had yard instead of workyard and shipyard. What I have also done, and I just didn't redo it for all of this, I can put a variance in by the total revenues and the total expenses so you guys can see where those variances are from budget to actual. And then we also, on the next page, combined commission, executive, and accounting to just be under one labeled administration. So these are all just proposals. If that's how you guys would like to see those, we could move forward. If you would prefer to have them all split out as they have been, we can do that too, so.
And this is, you don't need to know tonight.
I do not need to know tonight.
This is just, you know, Steve had suggested that we kind of do this sort of format, just from the quick look. Mm-hmm. I still personally like having our detailed, pages, because if something pops up here that you wonder why that is, mm-hmm. you really need to go to your detail one to find out that, oh, it's because, more of the quilting was way down or something.
Thank you. So I emailed a question to Larry and Amy today, and I just want to bring it up here. It would be really helpful if, for me at any rate, that if we had some sort of a variance report established. I don't mean some kind of exhausting thing that's going to have to Amy or somebody's going to have to make a comment on every time there's some sort of a variance, but have a percentage level of variance where it does trigger and has some sort of a way where a single sentence, 10 words or something that can be written in there to identify, why is this so out of whack in the night of the RV thing, which, was obviously, it's like, gee, what happened there, And I think that just from a transparency standpoint, it would be really helpful, because there's a lot of the folks that look at this budget too, other than just us. And it may save a lot of, a lot of problems in the future. And that's just common accounting. And my background, where I came from, that was something that was actually one of the things I was responsible for. I had to do a monthly P&L variance report. And anything, in that case, anytime anything was over 10%, whether it was above or below. And I'm not suggesting that 10% be applied here, because this is a much different animal than what I was involved with in the past. But, it's some number. I feel that if we could establish something along those lines with some percentage that would trigger an actual variance report be associated with this document, would really be a helpful tool.
And most of our revenues are, and always have been, spread over a 12-month period as far as budgeting. So you'll see in February, I think Steve's question was on Point Hudson nightly RVs, where in February, so far year to date, we have budgeted $37,500, but we've only collected $12,600. It's because we take our total budget and then just allocate it over the 12-month period.
Their 2014 budget for that.
Yeah, it's February, the winter time, it's, the weather's crummy, and that's your choice in doing that kind of accounting. There's some folks might actually try and plug in, well, I know it's going to be really crummy, and so we're probably going to have 50% or whatever, occupancy, but that's another issue.
We have the previous year's numbers. Couldn't we utilize those in some fashion to get an idea, a better idea?
They're here.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, that's on a different report. See, that's the whole point, is that Larry wants, says, I want the numbers in the back to look at, and they're on this report over here, but I'm trying to look at a report here to figure out what where we're going, trending. And in order to do this, it seems like you got to get out a pile of paper and go from here to here to here to here to here to find it.
And interesting enough, and, for the nightly RV, you look at the prior year, and the actual was almost 70% higher. For the actual compared to this year's was about $4,500, and last year's was about $7,500.
All that paper ones.
Anyway,
this is a good tool to look at, and maybe we can study it. And
before we leave Brad's issue, I want to look at it some more. I haven't had a chance to sit down with Amy yet. It might be a little easier to do if we did it like on a quarterly basis or something. Month to month, you can get a real, you get a real bad weather month and things like that, it could be way off. Mm-hmm. Just to try to reduce the number of words that we have to crank
out. I'm not looking for to, you know, create another full-time employee here, you know, it's just, but just from a common industrial accounting standpoint, variance reports are just, that's a pretty normal thing.
The other thing I noticed with this report, I like it, but it's kind of like, gosh, if we're going to break out how, I don't know, how big are variance reports? I mean, how many pages are we looking at if we did the whole thing as a variance report?
My past experience, it was a single line item. It was just literally a single sentence. There was room on the paper to make that happen, where somebody could just write in a comment, you know, five words, crummy, what, you know, three words. The weather was crummy, right. You know, whatever. Just Bertram?
I really like this report that has the simplified profits, revenue direct spreads to gross price. And it raised an interesting question that I just to throw out, was that the shipyard, we had $87,000 gross profit, we were budgeted at 34. It's tremendous, that's 200% improvement. And so, you know, if that is due to low rates, is how much more of a target would you want for improvement? I mean, that's a fantastic improvement in revenue. So maybe there is an advantage to keeping low rates up, but just making, you know, rolling in the environmental things. But it might be, you maybe should set, as a businessman, you say, what is our target for profits? And if each year it's goes up a little bit, how much is that? That's good. So the low rates have given you 200% increase in profits in this last year. That, to me, sounds like a really good thing.
Fishing was good.
Pardon?
Fishing was good.
Yeah. But, and not the low rates, you think?
What's that?
And not the low rates?
Well, I don't know. But
the commercial guys have had a couple good seasons in a row, and obviously if they're going to keep in business, their boat is their business, so they got to reinvest at some point. And we're seeing a lot of that. And you notice the lift's actually down, but our revenues are up because we've got a lot of big projects. You know, we haul them out, but they're staying in the yard, and that's where we really get our profit is the lay days. They may be back next year, they may not, because they did enough work.
This is my question, Larry, because I remember when fishing was bad, we rolled back the rates to kind of entice them.
Yeah.
You increase the rates, and they have a bad year next year.
Yeah, and it's kind of full volatile. Yeah.
I mean, in a way, this is a terrific report. You guys have made a lot of good money here. And so maybe you're on the right track just by holding steady.
Okay, we wrung that one out. Airport open house.
Brad asked us to be added to the agenda, so we did. Brad?
Well, I had some discussions with Mr. Taylor down here in regards to the possibility of getting this going, maybe even next month. He had some interesting comments, and it sounded like that there's a lot of the sound like all patrons of the airport were on board with this. Is that what I'm understanding? Is that correct?
With caveats.
Oh, I'm sorry?
With caveats.
Okay. Well, I mean, appreciate you guys just jump in there and just hear what you got in mind. And
well, I wrote up a little brief and give everybody a copy, and then I'd like to read it. Forgive the little typo at the top.
Thank you. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Gary.
Hey, Mike. My name is Eric Taylor. I'm a pilot down at the airport. And I'd like to talk to you this evening about the possibility of putting on an airport open house event. The most recent of many airport days fly-ins was put on by the Jefferson County Pilots Association in July 2011. In between all the work to make a fly-in happen, as well as the high cost of the special insurance required by the port for the event, which was over $1,000, The Jefferson County Pilot Association decided that it would be the last one for this foreseeable future. As a local pilot, I'm often asked by people in the community, when's airport days this year? And they're usually quite disappointed when I say there won't be one. This got me thinking that we should have some sort of an airport event this year. While there's still little to no interest in putting on a full-blown fly-in, I think an airport open house would be a great idea. This would primarily be a static display of airplanes based here at JCIA. With well over 100 airplanes based there, from antique biplanes to current models by Beechcraft and Cirrus, and everything in between, we shouldn't have any trouble putting together an interesting static display. Now, what I envision is a Saturday event, probably from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., with all the display aircraft to be in place before the start of the event, and to remain in place until the event is over. Therefore, there would be no mixing of pedestrians and display aircraft in motion in the display area. I do not envision any special activities such as sightseeing rides, Young Eagle flights, hot air balloon rides, etc. Just a simple static display which would be easy to control and which is a non-flying event should not require any special insurance. The pilot community can do all the coordinating of the actual event, including arranging for an article in the Fort Townsend Leader the Wednesday before the event. I would be more than happy to be involved or that to handle the whole thing myself if need be. I feel an event like this would be great PR for the port and for the airport itself. I would like to see the port get on board, first of all, by okaying this event, and secondly, I'd like to see him sponsor the event by arranging and paying for two additional outhouses to be located near the display area. I'd also like to see the port have a presence at the event, perhaps a booth under a canopy with the port commissioners and port administration on hand. I haven't talked to everybody, but hopefully the aircraft businesses on the field, Tailspin Tommy's, Fort Townsend Aircraft Services, and the Fort Townsend Aero Museum will be interested in participating as well.
Did you talk to Jerry Tio?
Very briefly on the radio. He was taken off and I was landing.
Okay.
I've got an email from Jerry. Did you copy on that?
I don't know. I don't think I did.
He's interested?
He is. And with the caveat that, you know, he'd like to have his organization make some money doing airplane rides, and but he would offer some sort of a discounted ticket to the museum for people that came out for airport days, you know, on that day. So I mean, it's more on board than it's been in the past. It's a positive thing. You know, I talked to Tailspin Tommy's, and I talked to PT Aviation or Aircraft Services, and those folks are on board. In the past, I think, I don't know to what extent Tommy's been involved, but
Scott,
you know, it's kind of before Scott wasn't.
Yeah, I think it's before.
Well, Tailspin Tommy's is a business. Scott Erickson is a right operator of that business.
So, but you know, I don't know. Those are businesses are certainly benefit from promoting the airport. And I think the airport could use some promotion with, you know, with the public.
Now, would you be advertising elsewhere? You know, hoping to get visiting pilots in, or okay?
Well, not in my envision. Number one, if you plan on visiting pilots, you leave room for their planes, and then you get the weather skunky here or basically anywhere, you don't get them. Yeah, and then you've got the moving aircraft out there amongst the pedestrians.
The having a static display and having a limited staff to marshal people is quite a piece of geometry to do. It pretty much corrals this into the area without shutting down the taxiways to get the fuel pumps. It pretty much puts you on that piece of tarmac where the customs is, where the helipad is, in front of Jerry's hangar. So having Jerry on board is not optional.
So Eric, how do you feel about that in terms of, you're not envisioning shutting the airport down for a Saturday?
No, not shutting anything down.
Right.
My first thought was to have the event on the east ramp, okay? Number one, that's where the helicopter pad is.
Right.
Well, most of them helicopter guys land in the grass anyways. That wouldn't be a problem. First airplane out there, cover the H and everything's good. Secondly, the customs area is there. I wouldn't see a problem with that. Talk to the customs guy ahead of time and arrange an alternate customs location for that day only. That should be no big deal. The trouble with the ramp location would be, number one, if the museum does not care to participate, I could see where they would have a gripe, because that would, shutting down that just that end of the ramp, which is isolated, would kill their access to the airport, number one. Number two, the other downside to locating over there is there's room for only a limited number of airplanes. It's kind of hard to tell. I don't know. I guess maybe 25. I mean, if the museum put out 5 or 10, that only leaves another 10 or 15, which isn't very many.
Probably from a space to do it perspective, that the unbuilt areas down below would be ideal. The problem is that there is no access to that short of walking down the taxiway, and then we're right back in having to have very tight control of you know, non-aviation savvy people that, you know, are talking on their cell phone and walking the propellers.
And that's why the insurance is always high with the traditional fly-in. They've always been fly-ins before, where you want pilots coming from the region, spend the exhibits to do the whole weekend. And someone would arrive on Fridays and all that. But, you know, the insurance company would look at the airport and then see all these, you know, three-year-olds running across the grass, across the taxiways, and you've got active taxing.
So how would we allow Jerry to do some rides? I think that'd be, I mean, like, I'm thinking of some with the RC club, right? Mm-hmm. And so we participated in the air affair at Squim last year at the Squim airport. They had real planes flying in. We had the RC planes flying around, and we had hot air balloons flying around. The hot air guy didn't really like the RC planes flying around his balloon. But, I mean, we were doing all of that, so it's possible to do that.
Well, we've done that in the past. We've had, I'll tease back in the glory days, we had Port Townsend Airways doing scenic rides. I had arranged a guy to come over with an antique airplane and do rides. This is way before the museum got started.
We had the biplane guy doing rides.
Yeah.
I went up in the dome on the Nimitz as I went down. I told him, don't do that again.
Yeah. Well, what I got thinking after I looked at the limitations of operating on the ramp, I was thinking we should do it on the infield. What we did one year, we painted off a little crosswalk across the ramp at the corner by Port Townsend Aircraft Services. Arlington Fly-In does this every year, and they've got a crossing guard at each end of the crosswalk. And if there's airplanes in motion, which a lot of time, on a nice day, there's going to be airplanes. On a mediocre day, there's not going to be that many. Have a couple people standing by if there's aircraft in motion. You stop the pedestrians until it's clear, and then you march them across. Two people is what that would take. The other benefit to doing it on the infield, there's room for more airplanes. We've got, a few years ago, it was documented over 100 airplanes on the field, I believe. I counted up the hangar spaces. There's hangar space for about 160 airplanes at our airport. They're not all full. I would guess we have 125 or 130 airplanes there.
Yeah, we're about 111 based that we're aware of.
Yeah. Well, So let's say 50% of the people want to show off their airplane. There's 50 airplanes. They're not going to fit on that ramp. So on the infield, you'd have relatively unlimited space. Jerry can do what Jerry wants to do. If he wants to do rides, that's part of his deal, not part of the official event. That's my take on it. I mean, he's participating great, but we're not, you know, me or whoever's in charge of the open house is not taking responsibility or whatever for what he's doing. If we stay off of that ramp, that leaves room for him to load up, do whatever he wants to do. As far as people running across the ramp, when it's a busy weekend, a lot of people are out from town, there's people running across that ramp anyway, so, I mean...
Yeah, there are, you know, a lot of people who lunch at the Spruce or breakfast, and then they walk out. Look at all the...
I have nightmares around the...
Well,
the
we've been pretty lucky, and most people have shown some common sense, so...
A lot of those people that are coming to the Spruce Goose for, well... So people that drive to the Spruce Goose get lunch and then run across the ramp. Well, okay, so that's the equivalent of what you have with Joe Public coming to an airport day.
Not quite as many though.
Not, but in the airport day, it just exaggerates it because now you've advertised it and I don't know. We had people the last one. We had people coming and going all day, and it's just got to be a little bit hairy. The crosswalk, we did paint a crosswalk across the ramp, and we had people stationed at both ends, but, you know, without taking the people in a clump and marshaling them across, they get on the crosswalk, and then they take off on a diagonal down the ramp. And you can't control
it. You could make that pretty self-explanatory. Yeah. You got to stay on the cross.
Of course, it was just a good day. This actually is a lot better proposal than what I had envisioned. I was thinking of a full weekend flying like we've all had out there. You just, in the old days, the EAA actually put them on. And we all know when Linda Swisher was alive, she was kind of the ball of energy that made all this happen. When this came up, my first thought was, geez, you know, if they want the port to put this on, we don't have the staff or the capability of doing it. But if the pilots are willing to do that, I've already asked Amy to check with our insurance company about doing the rider on our insurance. I think it would be prudent to protect ourselves personally and the taxpayers. We'd still have to have something. Even if Jerry has his own insurance, we all know if there's some tragedy, we're all going to get sued.
And, are you guys all right if I talk to Jerry about this?
That's fine.
That was one of my big concerns because he never has participated before and for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's been kind of a disappointment in the past, but I mean, as far as I know, the letter, the email to me kind of came out of the blue. We hadn't really approached him about it.
Well, I kind of went through back channels.
I think the rumor's going around, so you probably heard it.
Yeah, it was pretty direct, but it was clear that, you know, there was a profit motive going there, which is fine.
Well, Jerry's looking out for the museum, as Jerry should. My whole idea with making it an open house, display only event, and not any kind of flying event was to avoid insurance requirements. That's kind of a deal breaker, because, you know, if we've got to come up with $1,000, I don't even know if the pilot club has it or wants to spend it.
The pilot club has for the last three, four years not accepted membership fees from anybody. So the pilots
broke.
Club is an organization that's a booster organization, and it runs
somewhat dormant right now.
It has no fund.
Yeah, I noticed your website has been updated since 2012. So.
the last airport days, my wife and I paid for the balloon rides for everybody and Northwest Hangars, and I think the port kick in some money for insurance.
Most airport events, fly-ins, open houses, I was on the Washington State website, I think, see what the dates too. Most of them in July. I think there's one in August. July's a tough month, especially in the local area, because we used to have it on the same weekend that the Lavender Festival was going on in Swim, and, you know, that's where the tens of thousands of people went, including locals.
I thought you were you thinking September?
I didn't really have a date figured, but we don't have.
If you don't have to fly to it, if it's not a fly-in, if that's not the fly-in, then, you know, putting it outside of the middle of the high season has its benefits. And, you know, the people won't have conflicts for the weekend. And in terms of getting volunteers to help, you know, with the organization of it, I mean, you've got a better chance of getting volunteers if they're not.
Well, yeah, we've always provided porta potties. Actually, four is what we've always provided in the past. That's not an issue. I think the issue is to get word back from our provider and see what Amy made the call. We just haven't heard back. See what that call is, and then the commission needs to tell staff, do you want us to pursue this? Meet with Eric and Bill and whoever else might be interested. And
hey, Larry. Back in September 2010, you adopted the nonprofit funding request that had the requesting organization fill out things how does this relate to the port's mission of economic development, tourism,
that's true.
How many people does it serve, the geographic area, and that provides a nice paper trail
true.
Audit to show that this is actually linked to a public purpose, so that you have an application, and maybe that would be.
Would you guys mind filling that out? You probably are aware, it's on our website.
So it's
in your description, the POTS Association, definitely a nonprofit.
Yeah, more nonprofit than any.
It's on the port's website.
Like
it's on the port's website.
Well, what is it called?
A nonprofit funding application.
It's under commission.
Yeah.
New policy, commission, new policy, nonprofit.
Under commission or for information, one of the two.
I think it's under commission. I just brought it down for another nonprofit.
Do you think a lot of the guys out there are interested with this, Eric? Yeah.
Well, you're a pilot. You're based out there. Would you put your bonanza out on display?
Yeah.
Would you be interested in doing that?
Yeah. I'd rather fly my RC airplane out there. Hope I can get to do that.
It's a commission network.
Well, I don't know. You never know what's going to go on. I mean, I talked to some people one time. We were having a fly-in, and the weather was crummy, and nobody was coming in. And I told somebody, Jesus, you know, we got like three airplanes out here, and they're all based here. I go get yours. Well, it's only a Cherokee. And I go, it's an airplane. A lot of these people from towns don't know a Cherokee from a Waco. It's got a propeller on that end, and it's got wings over here. And, if, you know, people walk out there and they love it. They look at an old funky Cessna 150,
Did Nick Reed's
play? Yeah, it's great, there. You know.
Yeah.
That document, it's under commission, and then click on policy, and it's item number two, it's called nonprofit policy, and then it's got, you know, the actual application right there. So, and if you want to, you know, if you have any questions, just come on in.
But so, Eric, you're thinking not to advertise it much? Just put it in the
Well, if you say you put it in the Daily News, then a bunch of pilots from PA and Squim are going to hear about it, and they're going to come over. Now it's kind of a flying event. And now there's more airplanes moving, and it's just that much more going on. What I would do is call the leader and have them do a story on it, which they've always been willing to do in the past. And they come out ahead of time and they take a picture of a cool old airplane or something.
It's more of a community event.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm envisioning.
So why don't we...
like a port picnic, maybe.
Pardon me?
Like a port picnic. We can get the commissioners down there flipping hamburgers and stuff.
There's not that many fly-ins in the Puget Sound area anymore, but the ones that do go on, I go to most of them. I don't need to look at old airplanes or a bunch of airplanes at Jefferson. The people from town that aren't airplane people, this is kind of their one time to go look at airplanes, meet some pilots. Hey, they're not just a bunch of rich jerks. There are some poor jerks in there, too. You know? Like I said, I'd like to see a port present. A port present
trucks. And we always went to the other ones. We had our little 8x8 or 10x10 booth tent kind of thing. So, well, why don't we agree to meet here, check out that application. We'll probably get word back from the insurance company and come back to the commission with some ideas and some possible dates and...
Thanks, Eric.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is this
on a lot more manageable than that was taking the full
board. Is this on workshop schedule at all, or...?
April 9th there is,
On the 9th.
Yeah.
I'll talk to Jerry this week.
Great.
I'll send him back down.
That'll count you
something.
Okay.
He doesn't
bite.
Too bad. Not usually. He throws things
sometimes. Okay, so now let's move to the fun thing, the potential action item.
This goes back to the breakwater at Point Hudson. After I heard the $102,000 thing, I went back into the RCO office. There's another committee I sit on at RCO, and it's called the Boating Infrastructure Grant Committee. This actually is federal money. We do it all by teleconference, and then we send it off to, we grade it, then send it off to the feds. And then they grade it and either fund it or not. Long story short, it's Boating Infrastructure Grant. It's for transient boating, not boat ramps. It has to be at least vessels that will benefit from the project have to be 26 feet or longer, and they have to be powered. They can be sailboat, but they've got to have an engine and a propeller on there too. It's still a 25% match minimum. The grant cap is $1,455,000 per project. The application due date is 1 May. That's why I wanted to put it on the agenda tonight, because Eric has already started putting it together.
What's the transient definition?
Well, that's...
It's not you.
Yeah, you're the problem in this one. It's going to cost us money. We looked at this grant as when we redid the Point Hudson docks back in 2006-2007. And the federal definition of a transient vessel is 2 weeks or less. 15 days is not transient. And I've worked back then with Norm Dix, and I brought it up with Patty Murray that they really need to get real and change that definition. Because we did have permanent moorage in there. We also allowed people to winter over. It wasn't worth, the argument. I think with this project, because, very clearly calls out development or renovation of boarding floats, transient moorage floats, fixed docks, piers, buoys, dinghy docks, navigation aids, upland support facilities such as restroom, showers, utilities, and breakwaters, specifically.
What would be a transient marina? Who would have
that's the thing. I think we could make a good argument.
Bell Street's 100%.
Yeah, 100%.
It was built with big money.
Except for the tribes.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
I think we got a pretty good case, though. We put a pretty significant investment in there. We did create transient moorage. We may have to prorate, the linear footage that we have this amount of permanent moorage. When you count up all those 70 foot fingers, both sides, 50 footers, there's a lot of footage there. And we may not get go in for the whole 1.4 million, but we ought to at least shoot for, say, $1 million. And, the worst that could happen, they say no. But having sat on this for quite a number of years now, they try to spread so that as many states as possible get some of the money. Because of this type of thing, North Dakota doesn't put a lot of applications in for breakwaters, nor does Kansas or Oklahoma, so it's really just the coastal states. And Washington State, there's been a couple of times where RCO, who's the pass-through for the application, has put up calls begging for applications because nobody put anything in. And one year we approved although I voted against it for a project that I didn't feel met the standard for this kind of money, but you got funded, you know, $500,000 because they were the only application. So I think we ought to give it a shot and like the green light from the commission to at least try and go for at least a cool $1 million here, and that would...
So what does trying constitute exactly?
We've got to put just a written application. There's no briefings. It's not like the boating facilities program for the boat ramp where we've got to physically go to Olympia twice and make presentation, PowerPoint slides, etc. This is just a written application, describe the project, and submit it.
It's about 20 hours of Eric's time, yeah, and my time.
And then a couple hours of my time grading it.
So how come these guys will put this out and say, well, we're going to give you a month and a half to figure it out? Or, I mean,
well, we've known them, the big program. We just didn't really put the dots together that, hey, if this breakwater is going to be $1 million or $3 million or whatever it's going to be, we should be trying to tap some of this money. So this was, we've known it was there. We just didn't.
We could easily put it together, you know, but 1 minute. So.
And is there a time element in, that you can hold on to that money before you have to give it back in regards to actually, you know, utilizing the funds?
That's a good question. And this is you know, every 2 years, just like the other grant. So the money's good for at least that. And I think with us actively in permitting, I think it'll be good, but we'll ask that question specifically, you know, because the actual construction won't happen probably till 2016.
If we got the grant for one phase, phase one, and then we got into phase two, could we go back and redo it? Double dip by the same grant?
I asked that question. He didn't think so. He's read all the fine print, and he thinks we need to go in for the whole enchilada.
Right.
Not phase it.
No, but I'm saying, could we, like, get, what if we applied for $1 million, or 1.5, and we got $1 million? And then go back 2 years later and say, okay, now we want to finish and we want another one.
That's capped per project.
Yeah, per project. You can't go over that 1.4.
Okay.
So you could have a North Jetty project and a South Jetty project.
That might be possible.
Yeah. I mean, because we do have two jetties.
Breakwater first, and then, you know, this won't come up again for another 2 years, 2016, put in for the other breakwater, you know, which wouldn't be built till 2018 or something.
So now, since this isn't really requiring anything except the commission's agreement that we want you to do that, we don't need a motion or anything, just yes, go do it?
Well, I just wanted to be aware of it, that it's going to do it. It's going to do it anyway, but...
We can do a motion.
Okay, you want to make
a motion? I'll make a motion. We should do this.
I'll second it.
Submit for the voting infrastructure grant for the...
Okay. Alrighty, we've done it.
Thanks, Larry. Mm-hmm. Good job finding that.
I get the vote on it, too.
All right. I like the north-south jet approach too.
I don't know what my goal will be.
Okay, staff comments. Sue.
Just one quick one. The NMTA and WPPA Marina Committee is meeting tomorrow in Tacoma at the flagship Maritime Center at 12:30, and they're going to do a legislative wrap-up on the derelict vessel bill. No discharge zone and some other things, so I plan on attending that. But they'll pretty much kill the day getting down there and back. That's it.
Okay, public comments. Any more public comments? Then commissioner comments.
Well, I see you're breaking up the old the Chickamauga Magua down there today.
Oh, yeah, they started it. The log line's going to go back down. Yeah. The bow gone yet, but this morning.
Oh, is that time?
That's pretty much, I was down there this afternoon, and what a mess. But
he's going to take a photo of it and send it to
Yeah, that would be a good photo. It's that was a big project. And is there any more disposals looming in the near future that you've heard of?
Well, we're doing three.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah,
we've collected over the last year or
so.
I want to say, I don't remember the name of the vessel. I think there's another good-sized vessel on DNR's hit list. I'm not sure what the status is. A good chance at this meeting tomorrow, DNR usually shows up to this, especially since we're talking derelict vessel legislation. So I'm going to check.
Didn't Doug say that there was like a 30-some foot sale?
It's there.
It's there, getting munched up tomorrow.
Yeah, but I think there's another, you know, 80-footer kind of a vessel somewhere in Puget Sound that DNR's taking possession of. I don't know if they've got totally possession yet. You know, they have to go through that same 90-day due process.
So I'm just curious, how much of an impact was it for us as far as having available space for working space?
I talked to Doug a couple of days ago about that. You know, when we do a large vessel, we've essentially give up two spaces because you've got to allow that excavator in there and enough maneuver space. We try to put them where we did that one, the back corner, because that's almost the last area we utilize. And yeah, we have turned one or two boats, big boats, away in the last couple of months due to lack of space. But that corner has been tied up for the last year or two by little and little for houseboats. So I kind of looked at that back corner. We haven't really, it hasn't impacted so much. It's the Steinbeck boat and some of these others that are just sitting there that when we've been housing the Rich Passage for a long time now, you know, for Kitsap County. But this one didn't have too much impact.
Okay. Well, it's kind of leading up to another question I have. Is there a way to coordinate with DNR better that would facilitate a quicker time from a slow from all out to getting, you know, crunched up and put in the dumpster?
Probably the Chickamauga's is leaking. Couldn't stay in the water. Had to come out, and then they had to go through a legal process. They're normally pretty good. If a boat's floating, they'll bring it in and they'll crunch it within a week or two. But this one was one they had to pull out of the water quick, so.
Yeah, it's you know, it's more of a timing where they can get on contract to get it crunched up. Yeah, this one was a little bit longer sitting in the yard than normal.
How about a rate structure for a crunching up boat? Why do they get the same rate structure that a regular haul out boat gets? Why not say, you know, it's something other than that, because it's, I mean, we're dealing with a hazardous situation anyway. It's got holes in it. It's going to leak. It's,
yeah, you can look at it down there. It's a mess.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a lot more time on our part.
Well, they're responsible for cleanup. If we have to do anything, then we'll send the bill to DNR. So.
But still, you're saying it's taking up two spaces. Are they being assessed for two spaces?
I don't think they are either.
So, that could be
it. Yeah, we haven't done a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're dramatic when we do it, though.
I mean,
yeah, we've only done three or four.
To me, it seems like we're the logical place for them to do it.
Because they have the heavy haul out.
Yeah, so they're going to pay it one way or the other. And if they do say, well, we're going to go somewhere else, then okay, so much the better.
And we certainly shouldn't be giving them long-term storage discounts. I mean,
no.
We certainly should be charging
the Navy, you know.
Yeah, you guys should come back to us with a new rate structure for this crunch world.
I don't think we gave them a long
term. We didn't give them a long term discount, but
there's no discount on this.
That should be an active project to get that discount. But yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think that a lot of boats that are in the yard, I think, that are just sitting, we should have a structure that after a year that rates it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my yard guys were telling me that. These guys should be paying more if they're year,
and if we just flat told the DNR, it's like, you know, we really don't want your business anymore. I think they would be willing to negotiate because, you know, it's what other alternatives that they have.
Right. I think we should.
We can look at it. Don't expect this to be a cash cow, though, because
no, but I don't
like four of these boats in 6 years.
Right. Yeah.
But speaking of boats like that, what's the Rich Passage? You just sit here and nobody's working on it now, are they?
It that was a Norm Dix funded project, you know, to do a special low wake Rich Passage.
Right.
And they did all their testing. There's no more federal money. Kitsap County is left holding the proverbial bag, and so it sits up here. They pay a lot of money though.
And it's wingless.
And it's wingless.
And oh, it took wing arm.
It burned up. They had a heated blanket on it and a blanket cup there.
It was a lot of bad luck. I walked around it when they blew it up on the beach last year when they were down here. And there was two trenches about 6 feet deep and 20 feet long where the jets just kept blasting away. Nobody was with the throttles.
But from an aquifer,
sucking all the rocks through those jets, they got destroyed.
from an environmental standpoint, it's not causing any environmental issues.
No.
Paying a lot of money to us, so.
But it's not supporting any marine trades, like
kind of. It's not supporting anything.
Yeah.
It's a cash drain on Kitsap Transit.
Right.
It's pretty boat though.
Did you have your comments?
No, and I don't have any.
Oh, okay.
Other than I think we should visit DNR's rate structure.
It's a good idea. Okay, my only comment is that I didn't get to go to probably one of the most talked about energy lunches that happened while I was in the hospital. But they say that the video will be on the internet soon, so we'll be able to revisit it then.
I'll talk to you about that.
Oh, you have some input.
I got into a discussion with the speaker.
Oh, did you? Oh, cool. All right, well then if that's it, we'll adjourn this public meeting. Our next meeting is the public workshop Wednesday, April 9th at 9:30. And this meeting is called into recess, into executive session.
Legal matters, 15 minutes, no decision.
Exactly.